Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Friday, March 24th, 2023. And present today, we've got Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Colomb, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And before we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones, and I would like to, for a moment, pass the gavel over to Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Came to my attention that we didn't actually close public testimony last night, which is a required thing that must happen. So at this time, we were entertaining public testimony on the operating and mental health budgets, HB 39 and HB 41. And at this time, I will close public testimony for HB 39, HB 41. Public testimony is now closed. And at this time, the gavel goes back to co-chair, Representative Foster. And thank you for allowing me that cleanup.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Johnson. So this afternoon, we'll hear a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources, and we'll be looking at carbon as a resource for Alaska. And this presentation should provide a high-level overview of the concept and the two governor's bills, House Bill 49, which is the carbon offset program on state lands, and also House Bill 50, which is carbon storage. So at this time, I'd like to ask Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Designee John Boyle, as well as Deputy Commissioner John Crowther and Special Assistant Rena Miller to come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Foster, members of the committee. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. And with me, we have John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources, and Rena Miller, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. So it's really our pleasure to be with you today and talk about a topic that is really exciting to me, as it really represents a new opportunity for the state to grow its economy and diversify and increase revenues through some exciting new opportunities that I think will also play in well with what we'd like to do in terms of managing our other natural resource portfolios. So we're really looking forward to having this discussion, and certainly invite and encourage questions throughout this, because this has been certainly to be more of a discussion than a lecture, so we really look forward to hearing your questions and your insights.
If I could just very quickly, for the record, we've been joined by Representative Ortiz. So with that, please proceed.
Yeah, so the outline for today, we want to talk about the opportunities that we see the state having in the area of carbon management. We're going to talk a little bit about what is carbon management and what the opportunities are, and then Rena will walk us through what we're looking at with HB 49, which is carbon offset projects on state land, and Deputy Commissioner Crowther will walk us through HB 50, which relates to carbon capture, utilization, and storage. So what are our opportunities in carbon management? First, we have to kind of look at, you know, what is carbon management? So in general, what we're looking at are a few different things. First of all, we might look to capturing carbon that is produced as a result of industrial or, you know, other manufacturing activities. So, you know, in the little graphic, you see, you know, power plants, you see oil and gas operations, you see, you know, manufacturing of things like chips or semiconductors. You know, all of these activities generate carbon, CO2, as a byproduct of the energy used in those processes. So one method of carbon capture, of course, results in actually capturing that carbon as it comes out of a smokestack or through other means, and, you know, sequestering that underground, which is generally what we're looking at when we talk about carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Or we're also looking at things like nature-based offsets. So that is, There's a certain amount of carbon that's just released in the atmosphere, and so one of the ways that we can try to deal with that carbon, since we haven't captured it from the source, is to manage our lands, our forests, and other things in a manner that enhances those areas' ability to actually absorb and pull carbon out of the atmosphere and hopefully sequester it for significant periods of time. Another set of kind of terminology or vocabulary that one needs to be familiar with in the carbon management realm are these different, what we refer to as these different scopes of emissions. So when we're talking about scope one emissions, we're talking about emissions that are made directly. So this is, again, kind of running your power plant or, you know, what might be coming out of the exhaust pipe of your car. With scope two, we're looking at emissions that are made indirectly. So this is, you know, people that have to buy a lot of electricity to power an office building or some other sort of manufacturing process that they may have. And then lastly, with scope three, we're looking at emissions associated with a business's value chain. So, you know, for an oil company, that might be, you know, people utilizing hydrocarbons to, you know, fill up their vehicles or run a lawnmower, you know, things like that. So this is more kind of the consumer level. So with both scope one and scope two emissions, these are generally emissions that you're going to endeavor to deal with utilizing, you know, direct capture from the source. So scope one and scope two emissions fit nicely within the carbon capture, utilization, and storage realm. With scope three, you know, it's pretty hard for people to, you know, rig devices to try to capture carbon coming out of their car's exhaust pipes or you know, through running their lawnmower. So these are the types of emissions that you're generally going to look to manage through, you know, carbon offset projects. So, you know, enhanced forest management, mariculture opportunities, things like that. So that's how those scopes kind of fit in with the two particular pieces of legislation that you'll be looking at, and also as we talk about companies in net zero pledges, oftentimes companies will say, you know, our goals are to be net zero on scope one emissions or scope one and two, or some have said we want scope one, two, and three emission targets to be net zero. So on the next slide, this just gives you an example of one, that the market is still nascent, and two, it's rapidly evolving. I mean, there are myriad different credits that are available that are in various processes of being developed. You know, they're looking at, you know, credits that involve kind of household, you know, products and uses like stovetops and things like that. They're looking at, you know, credits more involved in the industrial manufacturing side of things. They're looking at credits that are, you know, relate to transportation, agriculture, forestry. And so there are myriad different opportunities here for the state to look at how we can monetize certain elements of the state's, you know, natural resources portfolio. And so one of the key characteristics of the pieces of legislation that are in front of you is that we're really asking for a broad framework, because we're not entirely sure which of, you know, all these different types of credit programs could really present the best opportunity for Alaska to monetize its resources. So we really are endeavoring to maintain the flexibility that we need to look at, you know, these different types of credits and credit programs and make that determination on, you know, what really makes sense for what we're trying to do here in the state and what might present the best opportunity for us, you know, to monetize those resources.
Got a question, Representative Galvin?
Thank you, through the chair. I'm really excited about this graphic in particular. I think it does so much to help us understand the complexity. And I heard you say that you would like in the legislation for there to be a lot of flexibility in order to be able to navigate the best opportunities for Alaska, I think. What I'm curious to know is if in this presentation at some point you are able to share with us currently where you see opportunities for the world market that are a good fit for Alaska and help us to appreciate, you know, the pluses and minuses of each.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Galvin, through the chair. We are going to get into that in our presentation. I think we do have a pretty good idea of what may, you know, at least immediately present the best opportunities for the state. But we're also kind of keeping an eye on this nascent and ever-evolving industry so that we can also, you know, maintain that flexibility to maybe take advantage of other opportunities as well.
Follow up, please. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I hope that through this process, there will be avenues for local communities to weigh in on whether that's the right fit for them as well. I understand you're looking at it from a market perspective, and I think that is really important. But I also hope that, especially if it involves the rural communities, we can manage to find the right opportunity, at least for the weigh-in that I think is so helpful. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So moving on. So again, in general, when we're talking about these two bills, you know, there's, I guess, one way to characterize it is that, you know, HB 50, which relates to carbon capture, utilization, and storage, that's, you can kind of think of that as the below-ground bill. So that's where we're talking about actually sequestering, you know, CO2 under the ground. With HB 49, that deals, you know, generally with land management, leasing, so on and so forth, we're talking about above ground. So those are opportunities with forestry offsets, mariculture offsets, you know, other projects like that. So that's just kind of a quick shorthand to kind of help, you know, characterize and understand, you know, what types of activities that we're contemplating under both bills. And I think, you know, it's important for us to also emphasize what these bills aren't, because, you know, we're aware that there has been a fair amount of information out there that's being propagated by different groups about what these bills may or may not be. And so, you know, we want to emphasize that both HB 49 and HB 50, these are not new taxes on industry or on Alaskans. The state is not looking to, you know, impose emission limits on businesses or entities that are operating here in the state. You know, we're not looking to tax Alaskans based on the carbon intensity of the activities that they engage in. You know, we're not contemplating instituting a cap and trade system. That is where we are putting emissions limits and then, you know, getting involved in state issuance of credits or things like that. And we're not looking at this as a mechanism to lock up land. So when we get into talking about, you know, carbon offset opportunities that involve state forests or state forested lands, you know, we're not talking about creating new conservation-like units that would have very restrictive, you know, land management schemes associated with them that would prevent Alaskans from utilizing these lands in ways that they've, you know, been traditionally utilized, you know, by Alaskans. So I think it is important for us to kind of emphasize, you know, what these, you know, programs aren't.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. My question is for the Commissioner Designee, and I'm wondering if carbon capture, does that include in the idea of, say we had a lease like in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that we held, and amortizing the value of that oil, does it have a value not developed, and is that part of that carbon capture element?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, that's actually a really good question. That's not exactly what we're talking about in terms of carbon capture or the sequestration part, but the sort of scenario that you've described, maybe not specifically to ANWR, but, you know, I've heard that there is talk about monetizing mineral resources that a party may have the right to develop, but for whatever reasons choose not to. So I think, you know, the example of an ANWR, you know, could be that instance where you look at how much carbon, you know, developing that resource, you know, would entail either, you know, through the actual mining of it or development of it or you know, later use of it through the value chain. And then, you know, actually if a state or a country or an individual who has the ownership rights that then decides to forego developing, then they could make an argument that they should be entitled, you know, to some form of compensation or value for foregoing those opportunities. So it's, I want to say that's very nascent, you know, at this point. I'm not aware that there is, at least to my knowledge, I don't know that has ever, anybody's ever monetized that before, but I certainly know that at least generally in the industry where people are talking about, you know, what kind of opportunities exist, that is sort of a scenario that is being contemplated by a number of folks. And I also would like to emphasize with what we're looking at with pursuing opportunities in the carbon offset space, you know, the state is really focusing on the voluntary market. So, you know, in the carbon world, you have compliance markets. So those are markets that are generally as a result of a government-regulated activity. So a very an example that's in front of us is the carbon credit cap and trade system that the California Air Resources Board has implemented. You know, that's the system by which we saw some of our Alaska Native corporations like Sea Alaska, like Otna, Chugach, and others utilize in order to actually monetize some of their private forested lands. That's a compliance market that is based on, you know, a regulatory structure. You know, in Europe, which has a very advanced and developed compliance market, you know, companies there have to operate within certain emissions bounds. And, you know, what we're seeing is that carbon prices in Europe, you know, are reflective of that, where they're actually trading over $100 per metric ton of carbon. In the voluntary market, these are markets that are, again, they're by their definition, they're voluntary. These are ones that companies, states, individuals willingly enter into based on their own, you know, goals to achieve certain environmental benchmarks. That they're not regulated. They're not governed by specific, you know, emissions limits or carbon taxes or things like that. These are sort of the markets that the state would be looking at. And, you know, in those markets, you know, I think we'll talk about it a little later. You know, you do see, you know, quite a bit of variation in pricing that is somewhat less than the compliance market. But again, there, at least from what we understand from talking to industry consultants and just sort of seeing what's evolving in the world, the voluntary carbon markets seem to be kind of where the future is heading. There's kind of a recognition, I think, amongst most governments that allowing, you know, businesses and industry to kind of create a market-based solution for addressing emissions is actually more efficient and effective than kind of a command and control style format for carbon management. So this next slide really just highlights, you know, where the growth is. So again, you kind of see here the market broken out between the compliance market in the voluntary market. So, you know, a couple of years ago, the compliance market for carbon credits was already at, you know, $850 billion in value. And there was, you know, tremendous over 15 gigatons of, you know, carbon that were transacted as part of that volume. You know, 2 years ago, the voluntary market was about $2 billion in value. So, you know, a much smaller subset of the overall compliance market. But as we, you know, fast forward to just last year, there was a tremendous increase in terms of the value in the voluntary market. You know, you can see there's estimates that, you know, in the next 5 to 7 years, you know, the market could be anywhere from 10 to over $40 billion in value. You know, I've seen higher estimates, you know, upwards of $50 billion in value. So there's a tremendous amount of growth, you know, occurring in this space. There's a tremendous amount of investment dollars kind of flowing into the to various programs within the voluntary carbon markets. And, you know, all indications are that there will continue to be increasing opportunities for the state to get involved, you know, in some of these projects. And, you know, one of the ways that the state of Alaska, we feel, has a competitive advantage in this space is that we've seen in the voluntary markets that the geography of the credits and the vintage of the credits, vintage being kind of what year they're issued, but the geography, credits that are issued in places that are perceived as being more pristine, as more iconic, is more desirable maybe than other areas of the world, tend to enjoy a higher premium on the voluntary market. So, you know, Alaska being able to market itself, you know, as we do, as a pristine environment that's in the Arctic, things like that, we think will lend itself to, you know, Alaskan carbon projects being able to command a higher premium just based on some of those criteria. So as we look to, you know, the state's resource base, of course, you know, this map is sort of hard to read on the screen, but, you know, the color-coded areas sort of highlight areas where the state has ownership, you know, denoted there in purple and some of the other lighter colors. You know, the state has a tremendous resource base in which we can look to monetizing for carbon offset opportunities. So, as a base, we have over 100 million acres that sit within our state land portfolio. Tens of millions of those acres are forested lands. And I think it's important to note, you know, the state has a number of state forests. You know, we have the Tanana Valley State Forest, the Haines State Forest, Southeast State Forest. You know, those are kind of separate entities versus just lands in the state that are forested in general that may not actually be part of a quote-unquote official state forest. And as, you know, our members from the Southeast understand, the state has over 30,000 miles of coastline and 60 million acres of submerged lands. And, you know, that is an area, again, where we see the potential for opportunities in the carbon space, both in terms of, you know, growing kelp that can, you know, be used to sequester carbon in and of itself, but also, you know, kelp being grown as additives for animal feed and other products like that that can reduce methane in agricultural operations like feedlots and dairies and things like that. So, again, just with the state's sort of land base and submerged land base, I mean, there's no other state within the United States, you know, comes close to the amount of acreage that we have to make available in the space. And so as we have sort of marketed Alaska to, you know, individuals and entities that may be interested in playing in this space, of course, you know, people are very intrigued by just the sheer amount of opportunity that kind of exists there. You know, one of the benefits of this activity, of course, is that it drives, you know, new state revenue. So, again, you know, this would be the state actually growing the pie as opposed to, you know, redistributing a shrinking share, which I think we've kind of got caught into that line of thinking over the past, you know, decade as we faced increasing budget challenges. So, you know, for us to be able to monetize state lands, state submerged lands in ways that they've never been monetized before, you know, really offers, you know, a tremendous, you know, value to the state to really grow and expand opportunities for new revenues and new resultant businesses and all the ancillary economic benefits that those types of, you know, activities entail. And then, of course, you know, our responsibility at DNR is to, you know, maximize and develop, you know, our state resources for, you know, public benefit and use. So, you know, by taking heretofore unmonetized resources and monetizing them, we feel fits in well with our constitutional obligations under Article 8.
Questions from Representative Stapp and then Representative Ortiz. Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair to Commissioner Designee Boyle. So I am
kind of curious how this effectively can work, because we have this permanent fund corporation that does investments, and my thought is, well, before we maybe dumped 100 million acres on the carbon markets, the permanent fund corporation might short that market. Have we considered, like, how these entities actually work in hand-in-hand with each other? I mean, obviously, I don't know. It makes sense to me, so I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, Representative Stapp, through the chair, I think that's a very interesting question. You know, the vault, there's, you know, different sort of markets that these voluntary credits trade. And I think, again, these markets are still nascent and under development. So, you know, an entity's ability to, you know, influence or, you know, manipulate those markets for, you know, certain price actions, whether that's up or down, you know, I guess I'm not familiar enough with what sort of information is available there. You know, clearly, though, just based on the sheer amount of interest and, you know, projects that are in the pipeline all over the world in this voluntary space, you know, businesses, industries, governments, you know, are expressing, I guess, some level of confidence that these markets should be an efficient and effective way to price carbon. And, you know, I think as the state, you know, it's certainly not our intent as DNR to just kind of go out and carpet bomb the state with, you know, carbon projects, you know, left and right. You know, we do want that maximum amount of flexibility. But, you know, again, I think our approach is going to be circumspect. We're really going to look to, you know, which specific areas of the state offer the highest, you know, bang for the buck, so to speak. And so I think, you know, we're going to, you know, the way that we would approach this would be, you know, conservatively. And, you know, certainly as time goes on, if, you know, we would monitor market conditions and sort of change our management goals accordingly based on kind of what we see.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Boyle, believe it or not, I'm kind of interested in that bottom portion, the kelp potential thing, 60 million acres of tied in submerged lands. As you say, that's more in my area, although we do have state forest land as well. How does that work in relationship to how would this program potentially bring revenue to the state? Are we talking about, first of all, are we talking about just naturally grown kelp out there, or are we talking about kelp farms? And then if we're talking about kelp farms, are we talking about people privately, like they do now with mariculture projects? They privately lease areas where they can raise mariculture products, but then they're the ones that are doing it, so they would benefit, I would think, from the trade-off rather than the state. How would that actually work?
Yeah, Representative Ortiz to the chair, that's a great question. And as it relates to kind of the way that the state can play, I guess, in this space. So the answer to your question is it could be both. If the state chooses to be more of a passive participant in this, in the carbon offset market as it relates to stuff above the ground or in our submerged lands, the state may just choose to lease lands to private developers that want to take forested land or want to take tide lands and develop a carbon offset project, whether that's they want to replant trees and manage the forest in a given area, or they want to go out and plant new kelp or maybe enhance natural kelp productivity in a given area. And then, you know, the state would recognize in revenues from the lease, you know, that it would, the lease revenue that it would collect from those activities. And then the upside to, you know, the value that the credits may hold, the appreciation that may accrue in those credits over a period of time would then, you know, be reserved to those private developers that are, you know, involved in that activity. Alternatively, the state may decide, hey, look, you know, we have a lot of you know, manpower and expertise in areas of forestry, in areas of mariculture. So we might decide as the state that we want to utilize some of our own lands and we want to manage or develop a carbon offset project on our own, which of course would involve more costs, would involve some risk, but the state might decide that, you know, the upside potential there by, you know, being a recipient of these credits and, you know, based on what we think that the value of those credits may be at some future date, you know, may make sense economically for the state to actually play a role in that area. So, you know, I guess we contemplate a mix of both, you know, both private developers going out and doing their own thing where the state just kind of sits back as the passive landlord and collects its rents versus, you know, opportunities where the state says, you know, we've watched this occur enough and now we know how to do it and we're going to go out and do it ourselves. And I guess I would just add as a corollary to that, you know, what we've seen with some of our Alaska Native corporations that have embarked on developing carbon offset projects, particularly in the voluntary space, they've entered into contracts with entities to develop, you know, a carbon offset project. So that is another private entity coming in and doing a carbon offset project on Alaska Native Corporation land. But a provision of those contracts has been, we want you to train up and teach our people on how to do this, on how to, you know, structure these programs. And then we've seen now these Alaska Native corporations move forward with developing their own projects once they've kind of figured out the nuts and bolts of how to make that come together and work for them. So, again, I think the state would probably take a very similar tact to that to, you know, understand how to do it. And what I think if we felt like we had a high level of confidence that we could do it and what the costs could be and what the risks are, then the state may be more interested in taking an active role in that to maximize state revenue.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
All right. So, you know, shifting a little bit to the carbon capture utilization and storage front, you know, what we are seeing, again, very similar to carbon offset projects, is that there is this growing trend of carbon capture utilization and storage projects around the world. And this is, you know, being driven a lot by, you know, areas in the world that have carbon taxes or carbon emissions caps. So, you know, it's actually incentivizing then private companies to, you know, actually deliver cargoes or, you know, conduct their operations in ways that kind of fit within these environmental targets. And so one of the better examples of this is that the, you know, oil company Occidental Petroleum back in 2021 shipped a cargo of over 2 million barrels of oil to a refinery in India that was certified as net zero. So that is, you know, Occidental had taken the CO2 emissions out of the its upstream side to offset the amount of carbon that cargo of oil, you know, would ultimately be responsible for emitting and certified that and then, you know, actually shipped that cargo to India. And so, you know, what you're seeing is with, you know, the advent of blockchain technology and the ability to actually distinguish what used to be a very fungible good, you know, that is you really couldn't tell a difference between one barrel of oil from the next. Utilizing the blockchain, you can say this barrel of oil that was produced in this place that we, you know, took the CO2 and the methane and other, you know, greenhouse gases out of the mix and sequestered it. This is a greener barrel of oil than that barrel of oil that's been produced in Saudi Arabia, where there has been no environmental efforts to, you know, reduce its overall carbon intensity. And so we are seeing a growth in that market to where, you know, oil that is green or, you know, quote unquote green that has lower carbon emissions than another barrel of oil might actually enjoy a premium. Or there may be certain refineries, certain countries that say we only want to buy oil that has, you know, that has been developed in a less carbon intensive way or where the offsets, you know, for that barrel of oil have been secured, you know, through forest offsets or some other type of project. So this is something that we are you know, seeing move forward. And specifically in the United States, you know, there's a tremendous amount of activity going on, particularly along the Gulf Coast with all the chemical and petrochemical refinery that's going on down there, and LNG exports and things like that, where, you know, there's a lot of CCUS projects that are in the works. There's also a lot of great examples of CCUS projects in both Wyoming and North Dakota where, you know, myriad activities like coal-fired power plants, ethanol plants, you know, other things like that are taking, you know, CO2 out of their facilities and injecting it under the ground. So this is, again, another growing area, and it's one that, you know, I think Alaska, you know, particularly has a competitive advantage when looking at other jurisdictions, in that, one, we have incredible geology. So the same type of geology that we have in the state that's conducive for oil and gas activity, like the sedimentary basin in the Cook Inlet and on the North Slope, those are the same types of rocks and geologic formations that make sense for sequestering carbon. And, you know, if you take a state, for instance, like North Dakota, North Dakota has very little state-owned land. It has very little state-owned subsurface. And so if a project developer wants to sequester carbon underground in North Dakota or another state similar to that, they may have to negotiate with myriad different landowners, both on the surface and subsurface, in order to come up with a commercial structure that works for sequestering carbon. In Alaska, they would only need to come to the state. And so just, you know, that factor alone would help incentivize, we think, this activity in Alaska. Plus, just the sheer quantity of CO2 that our geology is estimated to be able to sequester is such that, you know, Alaska could really be a world-class destination for sequestering carbon produced in other places if that's where the market evolves. So, in particular, we would look to countries like Asia, Japan, like North Korea, that have set emissions targets, you know, for their countries and, you know, desire to grow their economy but do it in a way that meets environmental benchmarks. Those types of countries may actually look to Alaska as an opportunity to ship CO2 here to sequester in our underground geologic basins.
Good. Questions from Representative Tomaszewski and then Representative Johnson and Galvin. Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, you spoke a little bit about blockchain technology. I'm somewhat familiar with it, but I've never heard of it used as a way to track oil or carbon or anything like that. Can you, for the folks listening out there, explain a little bit more about blockchain technology and how it would be utilized to do what you just spoke about? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Tomaszewski, through the chair. I'll try to, you know, I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I don't know that I can throw on another hat and be an expert on an entirely different subject. Blockchain technology fundamentally is a distributed electronic ledger system where you can keep track of, I guess, a particular transaction, and that, as it progresses down the ledger, can be verified that if, you know, such and such a shipment with such and such a number is certified to be, you know, carbon zero, you can sort of keep track of that cargo as it makes its way through kind of the world's, you know, transportation and distribution systems to when it arrives at its, you know, last port of call or what have you, or at its destination, that you can say that, you know, the oil that we're using here matches up with this, you know, particular identification number and is the actual oil that we wanted to use that's net zero. So it's, Maybe Representative Foster would do a better job explaining, you know, blockchain than I would. You know, it's the underlying technology that, you know, drives things like cryptocurrencies and other things like that. But it it's basically, it's this, again, it's this distributed ledger so that, you know, people that have computing systems that have nodes, there's a way to just verify that, you know, if you have one of a certain product, the ledger system would keep track of it in a way to ensure that you know that what you're getting out of that ledger is the product that you ordered versus some other kind of product that was interjected or intermingled. And I know that's not a very good explanation, but I guess trust me that it works. there's a lot smarter people out there that actually could explain this better. I meant to just reference it as the underlying technology that can help us distinguish a fungible commodity one from another.
I think you did a really good job at explaining it, actually, so thank you.
I agree. We've got Representative Johnson, then Galvin, then Ortiz. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the chair, I think I don't want to get ahead of things, so let me know if we're going to answer the question later in the slide. But I guess theoretically we, and it may be helpful if it comes to this in some kind of federal, I guess I'll say it's just marketing, but it's not exactly that. I would say that, you know, we could make our own oil be carbon net zero theoretically. That would be one way of addressing some of the federal concerns about Alaska's oil, and also, I mean, you know, our energy costs and so on. I mean, our energy that we're producing. So maybe we could show that we are doing things in an energy carbon neutral way. But, and I guess there must be someone out there. I mean, there's some registry, I suppose, or some organization that must have, because I thought I was actually looking at the next page, but, you know, coal, natural gas, biomass, and so on, that identifies the level of carbon that is needed to offset the use of each of those types of carbon energy, right? Someone out there is doing that. Otherwise, you have nothing to sell. You have to have this. So I guess my next piece to this is, when it comes to registries, I'm assuming maybe you'll talk about that a little bit. Is there any value in Alaska having their own registry and our own standards for, so we know what we're dealing with? So we're not, it's maybe not entirely set in stone. Some of this stuff is kind of subjective. And as this is a very new type of industry, and as Alaska is working forward on it, perhaps we need to be aware of exactly what we have and what we're selling and, you know, what we could do to maybe, you know, give people reassurance that we have carbon neutral. I don't know. It's lots of things to think about. So just a question of if you would just speak to some of that.
Yeah. Representative Johnson, through the chair, I think you asked some very interesting questions and ones that do merit some thought. There are various carbon registries out there for this voluntary market. One of the more important elements of a carbon registry, of course, that really is a key factor in driving the value for the underlying credits that these various registries are certifying is, are these registries offering up enough of a robust sort of certification process to ensure or to lend confidence that a given carbon offset project is actually doing what you claim that it's doing, which is taking that incremental additional, you know, one ton of CO2 out of the atmosphere. So absolutely, you know, one of the reasons why we think Alaska could enjoy, you know, price advantage in the voluntary credit market versus other jurisdictions is that, you know, having the imprimatur of the state of Alaska involved, where, you know, people have a high level of confidence that, you know, Alaska has a government that's not going to play fast and loose, that's not going to, you know, try to hide the ball, that, you know, you have confidence that if we say, hey, we're setting aside X amount of acres and we're planting this amount of trees, and based on our surveying of this, you know, section of land, you know, the we're, you know, our trees are going to be able to pull X amount of additional carbon out of the atmosphere, you know, that lends itself to a lot more confidence than, I'm not going to name any countries by name, but let's just say some other country that you might kind of scratch your head and think, I don't know if they're, you know, managing their forests like they're telling us that they are. So, you know, I don't know necessarily if it would make sense for the state to have its own carbon registry, but it's certainly something that could be discussed. But it also is important, I think, in terms of developing carbon offset projects, to make sure that you're utilizing a registry that, you know, has that track record of you know, assurance and credibility when it comes to certifying, you know, these carbon offset projects.
So, I guess, and I know we're going to get into the bills and so on, but I guess, you know, if we're going to invest in this, we want to make sure that we're not at the whim of some, you know, who knows what out there that could change at any time. And I guess that's sometimes the challenge with new stuff, you know, is making sure you're working with in good faith and have good partners that you're, you know, looking to. So
that's
very,
absolutely
very interesting. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, we've got Representative Ortiz.
Nope.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, Mr. Boyle, my question has to do, when I'm looking at this map and we're thinking about carbon capture, utilization, and storage, one significant element that comes to mind is that they're either, most of the projects highlighted here, either doing this CCUS near where it's being produced or in an area that there is a efficient transportation system to get there. So when we think of carbon development in Alaska, we think of the North Slope, but of course we have the great vast distance, the huge expense of transporting. So I am thinking in the back of my mind, that's not where we would be doing carbon capture, utilization, and storage, but you've referenced the geologic features that would lend themselves to us. So could you narrow us down so I've got a more visual picture? Is that Cook Inlet is what we're talking about as a basin where we could store, but not the North Slope because it's going to cost so much to transport it up there, or so it's going to cost a lot of carbon to transport carbon waste up there to then sequester it.
Yeah, thanks. Representative Hannon, through the chair. The short answer is the state is contemplating making all of the state's lands available for carbon sequestration where the geology is conducive to that. I think Deputy Commissioner Crowther will slides address a little more in more specificity, you know, what that entails. You correctly point out that in general for carbon sequestration projects, you know, the real sweet spot is basically co-locating the emitting or generating carbon activity with, you know, having the geology underneath it to sequester the carbon. You know, carbon capture, utilization, and storage projects are different than oil and gas projects, for instance. The economics of those projects are you know, there's a lot less margin there involved. So it's always going to be more attractive for a carbon developer to look to sequestering the carbon as close to, if not right on the premises of the facility where that activity is being generated. So, but to maybe get into a little more detail with your question, you know, there's obviously a lot of industrial activity that takes place on the North Slope. All of those processing facilities and power generating facilities on the North Slope that power the facilities that process oil and gas and water that's produced as a result of the activity, there's emissions associated with all of those activities. So the fact that you have all those big industrial processing plants on the North Slope, they're sitting on top of geology that's conducive for carbon capture, utilization, and storage, one could infer then that those types of activities would then want to be sequestering that carbon on the North Slope. But as we kind of work our way, you know, down the Dalton Highway, if we're going to do a little scenic drive across the state, you know, eventually we get to interior Alaska where we run into coal fire power plants. And interior Alaska also has sedimentary basins. Interior Alaska also has deep seams of unmineable coal, which are conducive geologically to sequestering carbon. So entities involved in the generation of coal-fired power may be interested in sequestering that carbon underground in interior, assuming that, you know, they find and delineate the right kinds of geologic formations that are conducive to that. And then you work your way down to Cook Inlet. You know, I think there's obviously, if there's some industrial activities taking place, you know, around Cook Inlet that produce emissions. But to be honest, I think that the key driver which would really unlock the Cook Inlet is a real asset when it comes to CCUS would be the development of an AKLNG type project where you would, you know, if we bring down North Slope gas and we start liquefying it in Nikiski, there would be, you know, CO2 emitted as a result of that activity, which would then require sequestration in that basin. It could also be that, you know, because of having that kind of energy stream available to the state, there would be opportunities then to develop hydrogen and manufacture hydrogen, manufacture ammonia. Both of those processes would, you know, create CO2 as either part of the manufacturing process or as a byproduct of the power generation required to produce that. Those kinds of emissions could then be sequestered in the Cook Inlet. And then, you know, kind of like what I talked about earlier, it could be at some point you could have a value chain if the state were producing, let's say, ammonia and quantities to export it. You could export that ammonia to Asia and you could backhaul CO2, you know, in those tankers. Now, again, this is very, you know, I don't know that the economic conditions for that exist today. In fact, they might not, but certainly on where we're seeing things going, it's not unreasonable to think that there could be a point in time in the future that activity could be economic, could make sense. And so that's kind of what we have in mind when we're looking at areas across the state that could be conducive for CCUS activities.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm very curious. I didn't see it anywhere else in this, so I hope you might expand a little bit on something you shared in answering Representative Ortez's question around the Alaska Native Corporations and the work they've already done, and especially related, of course, to the forested lands. And I know that they already have revenue coming in that is a pretty good example of a lot of revenue. And so I hope that you might share that as an example for one of the ways that you have talked about carbon offset as an above the ground example, because I think it can give us a certain sense of security that we have something that's already bringing in revenue, and maybe not to the state yet, and I'm not implying that we need to be competitors, but it certainly is a great example of something that we know in this current market is working, and there is a market for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Representative Galvin, through the chair, I think, you know, the governor looked at what the Alaska Native Corporations undertook, and that was one of the driving factors for him to have a mindset to looking to what the state could do to also sort of monetize those types of activities. I think Rena might mention in her presentation the study that the state had undertaken by one of our consultants that took a look at some hypothetical pilot projects that could be undertaken on state forests that we could monetize. So we have a very high level of confidence that there are myriad opportunities to monetize and have positive cash flow to the state. You know, I want to be very circumspect in terms of not over-promising, you know, what amount of revenues those could be, because I think, you know, again, we want to be very thoughtful on how we implement these programs, and we also want to see, you know, how the markets evolve, but certainly there's opportunity straight out of the gate for the state to start monetizing and receiving a positive cash inflow from some of these activities, and, you know, we're going to be working towards, you know, trying to maximize those opportunities wherever we can.
I've got a question for the committee. We can go until 3:30, but I would like, it would be great if everyone was here for the introduction of both bills. So I'm just wondering, I know oftentimes we've been going till about 3 o'clock. Do folks, anybody have to leave at 3 o'clock? If everybody's here till 3 o'clock or till 3:30, then I think we're doing okay. So please proceed.
All right. So again, on the next slide, you know, it shows us, you know, where CO2 is being captured by source. And as you can see, it's projected that, you know, we're going to be capturing, you know, many gigatons worth of CO2 emissions from coal, from natural gas, from industrial processes like steel and cement manufacturing, things like that, through biomass, other types of activities, which again just sort of lends itself to, you know, our belief that there's a growing market and a growing demand then for, you know, storage space to actually sequester all of this carbon. And lastly, here, as far as just kind of the overview, you know, part of, again, the reason why the state is looking to get involved in this space is that companies that are already in operation on, you know, in Alaska or are working to develop projects here in Alaska have set these benchmarks for themselves. So, you know, as you can see, almost all of the major names that we could rattle off as far as North Slope operators have set, you know, aggressive emissions reduction goals for themselves, you know, generally between the 2040 and 2050 timeframe. You know, with Santos is an example of a company that has also announced its intent to develop a particular project, in this case the PICA project, to be net zero on both Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. So if the state does not have a carbon capture, utilization, and storage regulatory framework in place, and if we don't have a carbon offset framework in place, you know, these companies will look to engage in emissions reduction activities in other jurisdictions, which means that other jurisdictions will then get to enjoy the upside or the new revenues involved with this activity. You know, we think it's important from a state perspective to offer companies that are engaged in carbon generating activities in the space to be able to offset their carbon emissions in the same jurisdiction where those emissions are, you know, ultimately created. And for us, it really fits in well with the narrative that, you know, many of you emphasized, you know, recently during the Willow debate, which is, you know, oil and gas that is produced here in Alaska is done in a manner which is environmentally responsible, it's more socially responsible, and done to a higher standard than in pretty much any other jurisdiction around the world. And so in our, you know, estimation, having this carbon offset and carbon sequestration regulatory regime in place just continues to add to this narrative that, you know, the state of Alaska can develop its resources, do so in a way that's environmentally responsible, that addresses, you know, the concerns that, you know, have been raised in numerous, you know, court findings and NEPA processes and, you know, so on and so forth to actually, you know, develop our oil and gas in a way that is environmentally responsible, specifically as it relates to the carbon intensity of the underlying activity. So you know, we think that if we, again, if we don't have this in place, these companies will have to look to other jurisdictions to undertake these activities, and the state will, you know, miss out on monetizing a resource that, you know, otherwise would be unmonetized, which is our empty pore space. And, you know, to steal a little bit of Deputy Commissioner Crowther's thunder, you know, the Alaska Supreme Court has held that our pore space under the ground is considered, our empty pore space is considered a mineral asset to the state. So 25% of the revenues or fees that the state would derive from an emitter, you know, injecting or sequestering CO2 into the ground would actually accrue to the permanent fund. So this would be a way for us to actually grow the permanent fund as well as just kind of general fund revenue streams, you know, through this activity, which to me is a really cool and exciting element, you know, of these programs is, you know, who would have thought that we could grow the permanent fund by putting an inert gas under the ground in an empty geologic formation? But that's exactly what we can do with some of these carbon capture utilization and storage projects.
Got a question from Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Commissioner Desneen Boyle. So just a couple of quick ones. So I see we have Conoco and Exxon and Santos and Repsol on here. And I'm curious, I mean, is this basically a self-imposed requirement of these kind of first world oil companies? I mean, does Sinopec do this? Does Rosneft do this? Does Saudi Aramco do this is my first question.
Yeah, Representative Stapp through the chair, that's a great question. Yes, you know, these are based on these companies, you know, their own volition to reach these environmental benchmarks. Now, of course, you know, I'm sure many people are aware there is a lot of debate in the investment space around banks and other institutions that have sort of put, you know, quote unquote ESG standards on their investments and things like that. But in general, you know, obviously most of these companies, if not all of them, operate around the world. Likely they operate in jurisdictions that may have actually very strict compliance requirements for emissions levels in their overall corporate activities. And in general, these companies are being pressured by shareholders and by their boards to achieve, you know, greater efficiencies in their operations when it comes to managing carbon. And I think there's also a recognition by, you know, I would say most people that are aware of what the reality is in the world that there's no such thing as just being able to immediately flip a switch in shifting from carbon-based energy today to completely renewable standard tomorrow. It's going to take a considerable amount of time and effort and money and mining and mineral resource development to even begin to build out the infrastructure that would support, you know, renewable energy, you know, providing a greater share of the world's energy needs at the same time that we have over a billion people in the world today that are still primarily burning wood and dung is their primary source of energy. Another 3 billion people live in areas of the world that experience energy poverty. That is, they don't have regular or reliable access to electricity. And, you know, people around the world want to improve their standard of living. They don't want to, you know, a lot of people don't want to continue to burn wood or dung to heat or power their homes. A lot of those people, they want to have, you know, electronic, you know, equipment to save them time to, you know, produce water, wash their clothes, have an iPhone, you know, things like that. So to be able to supply the world with energy that enables all of those people to have access to energy, but to do it in a way that actually reduces the environmental impact of generating all that power, these companies want to adopt these standards to try to meet that dual purpose of protecting the environment, but growing the overall energy pie for, you know, the world.
Thanks. Quick follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So thanks, Fred. Excellent detailed answer. Didn't quite need all that, but thank you so much. But I did want to follow up with basically, what I'm listening and reading between the lines, effectively, if we don't do this, we're not going to have a lot more Arctic investment in oil and gas. Is that my understanding? Just a good summary, because of these nature of these requirements that these companies that are currently investing are self-imposing. Like, this is a big deal to their shareholders, and therefore, you know, if we didn't move forward with something like this, say maybe your estimates on continued development of Arctic oil and gas would probably be lower or higher. That's the question. Thanks.
Our question, Representative Staff, through the chair. What I would say is that I don't know that it would completely drive out investment to the state if we didn't have this, but certainly I think it is a factor that would help promote or encourage development in the state if some of these companies can go back and say, yes, we're generating carbon in Alaska, but we're also sequestering and offsetting that carbon in Alaska. So I do think that would help them make their own investment cases to their shareholders, to their boards, about why investing in Alaska is not an environmentally irresponsible decision to make.
Thanks. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I really appreciate the presentation thus far and look forward to getting into a little more detail on both bills. I want to make a comment and then follow up with a quick question. I guess to piggyback off of the point that Representative Stapp just made, it confounds me all these years later that we can't quite spit it out that we're in a world of changing climate, of emitting too much fossil fuels into the air, and we have to change. We literally have to change, and we hope and we know from a practical standpoint that it's not going to happen overnight. Commissioner, you and I have talked about this in the office. We had a great conversation about that. But I just sit here and think about the Arctic Encounters event that's going to be happening next week and how there's going to be many emissaries from across the Arctic and a lot of detailed discussion about climate change and about the strategic importance of looking ahead. And as we're doing here today in front of this committee, attempting to take advantage of something that may not exist into the future. We know that this is, in terms of blockchain conversation, this is a cryptocurrency type sort of thing. And it's not just corporate boards, it's countries, it's scientists around the world that know that we're putting too much carbon into the air. We're burning up the planet to some extent. I'm certainly not chastising you, Mr. Boyle. I think you've done a fine job. And you're representing the subject very ably, but it's just I sit here in sort of a sense of confoundedness. All these years later, we can't talk openly about climate change. And I had this conversation with the governor a couple of weeks ago where I said we need to be talking more about it because this is a subset of a changing climate that we're all in. And as an Alaskan who was born and raised here, part Alaska Native, who supports resource development, you know, the Murbach storm and everything else that helps us get to where we're at with these bills, it's upon us, and it's going to get more pronounced down the road. I think we should be talking more openly about it, and I would recommend, certainly can't tell you, but in terms of prefacing this bill, we talk about in the context, it's not corporate boards, it's countries, and it's you know, the Paris Agreement and, you know, the rest of the United States, our neighboring Canada, the Arctic Research Commission that's going to be in Arctic Encounters, the Arctic Council, our Scandinavian friends, many of them are going to be up in Anchorage next week, are talking about the fact that we have a changing environment in front of us. And I like the fact, again, that we're monetizing it. I wish we could go a step further and have more global look at this thing, because those of us that live in coastal Alaska, Representative Foster's communities, a number of them were nearly washed into the ocean because of warming ocean temperatures. So I'll get off my high horse there to get to my question. My question is, yesterday we had a presentation on Willow and the presentation on oil revenue forecasts. And, you know, both of the slide decks were populated with caveats. You know, this might happen, that might happen, whatever, we don't know for sure. We're just sort of, but the 10-year plan presentation that came before this committee way back in January projected $300 million this year in money from carbon capture. It built up to $900 million. I think there was an intermediate step of $500 million or something, as a stair step was way up to $900 million a year. But relative to the presentation, presentations we got yesterday from your deputy commissioner was part of that, what level of confidence would you put in those numbers, the $300 million, the $500 million, the $900 million, and the 10-year plan vis-a-vis the probabilistic, the deterministic, I think that was the phraseology used in the Willow presentation. What level of confidence would you put in that money coming about based on where we're at today, and given the sort of the fact that, again, like cryptocurrency, this stuff is it's like the Northern Lights. It's flashing right before our eyes, and we hope to see it all the way through.
Yeah, Representative Edgman, through the chair, it's a great question. I'm glad you guys are not, throwing me any softballs here. So can talk about nuclear physics next, I guess. I think to answer your question, I might defer here a little bit to my deputy because I'm not 100% familiar with, to be honest, I haven't been looking at this really through the specter of the revenue generating potential in terms of actually identifying numbers versus just sort of looking at this from the potential that this is a way that I know we can monetize resources and we can do it in a way that really doesn't entail a lot of additional cost or expense by the state to kind of embark in this. You know, what I know that we do have is we have, you know, the reports of the, you know, the pilot project that our consultants have given us about, you know, potential carbon offset opportunities available kind of in state forests sort of that exist today is the conditions exist, which again lend itself to confidence that the state could receive, you know, some tens of millions of dollars in revenue from this. You know, when we start talking about CCUS, it will take us, you know, it could take us up to 2 years for the AOGCC to apply and receive primacy from the EPA to be able to start regulating class 6 wells, which are the type that inject CO2 back into the ground. So, you know, there's a lot of factors there that make me reticent to try to project or estimate what I think revenues could be by any date certain. You know, from my perspective, I'm just certain that based, you know, that the state can embark in this program, we can administer these types of programs with very minimal cost or investment required by the state. And I'm very confident, if not extremely confident, that we're going to achieve some net positive cash flows. But I guess I'm just reticent to try to guess on what that could be.
If I can just wrap up, Mr. And I really appreciate that because I think that's a good response. And the reason I asked you that is for the Finance Committee, and we've got $300 million baked into our revenue picture this year if we look at the 10-year plan. And we all know that there's a level of conjecture involved in that. I mean, none of us are going to the bank on it at this point. I'm hopeful that this is going to be a good move for the states. I'm supportive of it. But at the same time, this picture, reminds me of the ice forming in Nishigak Bay outside of Dillingham. You know, you look out one morning and it's all frozen. Then you look out a couple mornings later and it's broken into chunks. It's happening in real time. And I just feel like we need to be cautious about this on one hand as we go forward, we get involved, because it is a very much a moving picture. And these registries that my fellow co-chair brought up, there's 8 or 9 of them around the globe, and there could be a lot more in the future. Maybe Alaska has a registry at some point. We don't know yet. That might be too deep at the far end of the pool. But I appreciate your candidness and the conversation thus far. Thank you.
Maybe one just quick interjection in terms of timing that I think is worthwhile for the committee to consider is that so much of the economics, particularly for these carbon capture utilization and storage projects, are being driven by the increased amount of federal tax credits offered, you know, under 45Q of the Internal Revenue Code. Those credits, as they currently exist, you know, will sunset or expire, I think, in roughly 10 years, maybe just a hair under now that you know, we're a year or so into this. So, you know, one of the reasons why the state has been pushing so hard to try to get these bills, you know, heard and hopefully passed by the legislature this year is that we are dealing with a time certain with those federal tax credits. Those federal tax credits are really key to driving the economics of the carbon capture, utilization, and storage project. So we really think it behooves the state to have this program in place now so that companies can take advantage of those federal incentives and develop those projects.
Okay, thank you. So I think we're on to the introduction of the two bills now. Is that correct?
That's right. So now I'll turn things over to Rena Miller.
Okay. And if you can put yourself on the record, Ms. Is it Miller? Miller. I'm just so used to your former. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rena Miller, Special Assistant to the Commissioner at DNR. I will talk to you today a little bit more about House Bill 49, and that's the carbon offsets projects on state land, so the above ground portion. As a really broad overview, this bill would task DNR with exploring these carbon offset opportunities where they align with Alaska's resource interests and land interests and DNR's responsibilities towards those. They would enable carbon offset projects on state land and shorelines. They do not require anything. Sets up a framework for DNR to go ahead and look at where these will work well for Alaska. The bill does cap these project terms at 55 years, and I think that's important because we certainly hear of other projects in other jurisdictions that look to 100 years or even longer. The bill is going to cap these at 55 years. The bill also will protect existing land use by Alaskans. That would apply to those sort of generally allowed uses, the ways that Alaskans love to use their state lands to hunt, to fish, to set up moose camp, to snowmobile, to snowshoe, you name it. I think actually an important point before I move on from this is Representative Galvin talked a little bit about local input for these projects. There is in the bill a requirement for a best interest finding by the department, whether you're leasing state land to a third party for a project or whether the state is undertaking a project. And I think for those familiar, that process involves a public comment period, a lot of input, not just from individuals, but some consultations with local entities and governments and functions that gets wrapped into a final decision.
I have a question, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. On the third bullet there, cap project terms at 55 years. In terms of most potential revenue for the state, it's my understanding that the more valuable offsets are for longer periods of time. In other words, I think like 99 years or something like that. So in terms of just revenue for the state, if that's what we're trying to get here, why is it that we set ours at 55 years?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I think that's a great question. For a couple reasons. 55 years is also the length of time of a normal long-term lease. Thank you. A normal long-term lease of state land for other purposes in statute. So it's a period of time, for one thing, that we're generally comfortable and experienced with assigning land to a purpose and a use. 55 years is also sufficient time to do a project and have it generate a full suite of credits under some of the more likely protocols that the registries establish that would work well with Alaska's forests in particular and also other land uses. Depending on the registry, depending on the standards for different types of projects, be that afforestation, avoided deforestation, improved forest management, they all have different time lengths that are possible under them, depending on which registry and standard you use. So for those that seem most suited to ongoing managed land in Alaska, we think that 55 years is sufficient to materialize those 40-year project commitments.
So if I think I heard you correctly, then you're saying that there really wouldn't be an added financial benefit to the state by considering longer-term leases?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I think it depends on what other standards Alaska's lands would be eligible to meet and what time lengths those have. So potentially, you could generate more revenue through a longer-term project if that project standard is actually something our land is eligible for.
Follow up?
Excuse my ignorance in this area. So when you say what our lands are eligible for, who determines that eligibility?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, the eligibility is and we'll get into a little bit more okay. what the registry is, but the registry are that independent nonprofit entity that sits in the middle between a project and the buyer of these credits, right? Has a series of different protocols that cover different types of projects that you could do on, say, land-based things, forestry-based things. Each of those protocols will give you very specific rules as to what's being done on that land today, what kind of risk might be posed that would threaten removal of carbon stocks on that land, what your project would be for. Is it improved management to have active timber harvest but grow trees bigger and have them stay there longer, generating more carbon? Is it avoided deforestation where in other countries, particularly in the tropics, you are promising not to clear-cut a massive swath of forest and avoid that deforestation? That's not likely to be a scenario that applies for Alaska's land where we're not at that threat of some very large-scale deforestation. So those have some longer time periods related to them where the registries say you will commit to this period of time for this kind of a project. And it's that assurance that that carbon stock remains on that land for that time period. So again, depending on which standards and their time commitments required work for our land, it's possible that we could generate more revenue for a longer period. But I believe DNR is looking at this, yes, as an additional revenue stream for the state, but that works within its mandate to maximize resources and multiple use and to balance all of these other things on Alaska's lands.
And actually, if I could just add a quick point, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee, for the record. I believe under our land leasing statutes, we have the ability then to offer a renewal, again, of another 55-year lease, you know, to a project. So in theory, you could kind of go up to 110 years with a renewal. So there are mechanisms like that already in place if we were contemplating lengthening a period of time.
Representative Ortiz?
Last question, I promise, Mr. Chair. You know, and again, from a layman's perspective, totally here, it would seem like the market, I mean, while we could extend it for another 55 years, that's 55 years later that we would choose to extend it, but the original purchaser of that offset or whatever you call it, they're not going to know that. So for them at that time, the value is definitely lower at 55 than it would be at 99. Is that correct? Or than it would be at 110 if you doubled it. In other words, they don't get the benefit from that. They have no idea whether that's going to happen or not. So they can only deal with what they see before them, which is a 55-year opportunity versus a 99-year opportunity. So at that point, the value is less, correct? I'm asking. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Ortiz, to the chair. You know, to be honest, I think that's something we'd have to look into to get back. Clearly, a project developer could say, well, we know under Alaska statutes that, one, we can lease these lands for 55 years, but there's an option for us to renew that lease for an additional 55 years. That's already known because that's how the law is written today. So I would assume that, you know, there could be a mechanism in place there that would perhaps weight or value those credits kind of based on the existing statute. And, you know, I think there's certainly if there's ideas that we could or should be leasing our land for longer periods of time, I mean, I think that's a very reasonable kind of inquiry to make and discussion to have as we think about how, you know, what our policy, you know, positions are when it comes to disposals of state land for a set period of time.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Ms. Miller.
Okay. Moving on to the next slide. The bill, again, kind of takes two paths to a potential carbon offset projects on state land. First of all, it looks to a process to enable the state to lease land to third parties for some kind of carbon management purpose. The second path is it establishes that carbon offset program at DNR for the state itself to undertake projects on state land. In that case, they're not leases contemplated. The state would remain the proponent of the project. The bill authorizes the use of the three state forests, Haynes State Forest, Southeast, and Tanana Valley, for only those state proponent projects that would fall under that carbon offset project program at DNR. So we wanted to, the commissioner talked a little bit about how Alaska has this tremendous resource base that offers a lot of potential, and we wanted to bring into the discussion a consultant report that DNR procured by a company called ANU that really affirms that potential in our minds. It's not conclusive or exhaustive as to the state's opportunities for carbon offset projects, but it does affirm that there are some projects that they can identify that could be up and running fairly quickly and that do bring some revenue potential there to the state. ANU, and you have this this report in your packets, I believe. But they identified three pilot projects. They looked at the state forests in Haynes Southeast and also in Tanana Valley and also forested state land around Mat-Su. These are all places with eligibility for timber harvest or active timber harvest. So they would fall under this improved forest management kind of style of project. Those that would be the standard or the protocol that would be used. The registry that offers that protocol or standard is called the American Carbon Registry. It's one of four major registries operating in North America, has a lot of forestry projects, and I believe there are several other Alaska-based projects on Native Corporation land that are enrolled under that same protocol. When we look at the ANU report, they estimate the potential revenue of all three of these if one were to undertake all of them. At around $81 million over 10 years, over 40 years, that could look more like $311 million. That revenue potential, of course, is for these early look at a pilot project. These projects could change a bit in final contemplation or design as feasibility is firmed up. So they may have additional or lower revenue components as that happens. And I believe that the committee asked for a map that just sort of depicted where these projects might be in relation to everyone's areas of interest. So at the bottom right, you have the Haynes Southeast, and you'll see the Haynes is the larger airplane-shaped blue up at the top of the oval circle. And then the Southeast State Forest are those less contiguous parcels down below in dark green. If we go up to number two, Tanana Valley State Forest, you'll see a circle around some blue parcels there. I believe that the report, you know, also talks about the potential to add some additional land in that area. There's potential to go beyond the initial pilot. And, of course, in number three, you'll see some lands circled there in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, so my question, we're talking about the three state forests. I don't have the complete bill in my packet, but I did have the sectional. In reading, it appears to name only the Haynes State Forest. And so that indicates to me that a specific decision or resource or research indicates that forest in particular would be beneficial. But here we continue to reference the other two state forests, but the bill specifically names them. So can you help me understand that?
Of course, Representative Hannon through the chair. The bill makes all three state forests open for carbon management projects by the state. The reason that it calls out Haynes specifically is because Haynes State Forest and Resource Management Area was placed into statute at a different place and time than state forests generally. And so where you have section, 7, 8, and 9 talking specifically about Haynes, we then go to sections 10, 11, 12, 13 that are state forests generally, which then would include both Southeast and Tanana Valley.
And Mat-Su?
Through the chair, Mat-Su is not a state forest at this point. It is forested state land with timber harvest potential.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Please proceed.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Crump, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, through the chair. So when you identify these areas, are we, I don't know the whole process of how somebody comes in and does this, but are we taking in consideration of any sort of local person right now that's providing a source, or is this going to be a partnership kind of thing? I mean, you know, trying to just work it all out.
Representative Kronk, through the chair, I think the next couple slides might really answer that. We're going to look a little bit about who the participants are in one of these and also what the process is. And will you make sure to ask again, please, if that doesn't answer it?
Fair enough.
Okay, thank you.
And Ms. Miller, before we get too far away from slide 17, you've got revenue potential of all three, approximately $82 million over 10 years. I think the key word here is probably the potential, because as I look at the fiscal notes, you've got $400,000 in revenue and FY25, and then you got $700,000, then another $400,000. So that's about $1.5 million. So I think the expected revenue based on what we think we would be doing for sure is about $1.5 million per year, but the potential is up to $81 million over 10 years, so that's like $8 million a year. So that's the potential is the key word, I guess. Is that right?
Representative Foster, I think potential is really important to keep in mind. In the fiscal notes, we did not incorporate the anticipated revenue to the state from the projects. We felt that it was most appropriate. These are potential at this time. We want to make sure that what does come in at some point is an accurate depiction, and it's very hard to say at this point. Although we have the pilots identified, which projects where would we undertake, in what order, how quickly, and that would be a key factor in what the state receives then.
Great. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. So what we're looking at in this slide is just an effort to sort of lay out who the players or participants are in kind of a carbon offset project. And I'm going to focus a little bit more on this concept of a project that the state undertakes on state land through that new carbon offset program within DNR. On one hand, you have the proponent of the project. That's the person that has that land, that has the resource, that is going to hold the revenue from the project. And that would be, in this example, the state of Alaska. And then on the other hand, you have ultimately the buyers of those offset credits. And as the commissioner talked about, these are often companies that have those voluntary emission reduction targets. They're looking to purchase these credits and be able to offset their emissions ledger through that. In the middle, you have a registry, and the roles of the registry, I think, are really crucial here. They exist fundamentally to protect the integrity of those credits that these people are buying, right? So they're setting these rules and these protocols using scientific, peer-reviewed work. They're very dense and mathematical and scientific. They want to make sure that these projects are done in a way that is legitimate, that actually generates the emission reduction that's being claimed by the issuance of these credits, so that these buyers can have confidence that when they buy a credit from your project, they are getting something that's real, a real emission reduction credit, and they won't be accused of things like greenwashing, right, where a company is potentially making big claims about the environmental benefit that they're doing that doesn't hold up when you start looking at it. So the registry protects that integrity of those credits and is really a crucial player. I know Representative Johnson had some questions about maybe an Alaska-based registry. To this point, the registries are nonprofits that are very distinct from either the proponent or the buyer as they exist today.
We had a question of Representative Galvin and then Representative Cologne.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a quick question on this particular slide. Who pays the registry? Is it the buyers or the state of Alaska or some combination, or is it different everywhere?
Representative Galvin, through the chair, thank you. So the project proponent develops their project. The registry will charge you, I think it's with the ACR at least, the American Carbon Registry, it's maybe a $500 fee to open an account with them. It lets that sort of exchange start as you're developing the project, the back and forth with the registry on your standards that you have to meet. The registry would, at some point, once they've proven up your project and you're able to demonstrate that you're achieving the emission reduction that your project is designed to do, then they will generate credits to you, to the project. When they generate those credits, they assess a fee based on that so that they can fund their operations. Does that answer?
I think that answers very much so. I just, if I could, one quick follow-up then. Who pays that second fee that may come up, is that the state or the buyer? Just
Representative Galvin through the chair. It would come off of the credit issuance. It's like a portion of the credit being issued is reserved to the registry as their fee.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair. So this is kind of something that's just gone through my mind as the slides go by. One is the term locked up. It's not going to be locked. The properties, the land's not going to be locked up. So when you look at the question to whether to do it 99 years or 55-year contract, I'm glad you're not doing 99 years. This is a brand new idea. I would hate to get the state involved in something for 100 years that we don't know much about to get a couple extra bucks. So I appreciate that. But even 55 years, that's a pretty big commitment. And I know we talked about this a little bit before, but if you're taking a land and selling carbon offsets, there is a sense that it is locked up in some way. Now, I can hunt and fish and do four-wheelers on it, but you have to keep the trees to keep the credits, correct? So how much use actually can we have? If this forest is going to have a 55-year contract on it, and DNR is charged with maximum use of the land, let's say it comes up to 40 years and actually something comes up that actually would give us better use of that land and we're tied up in these carbon credits, what's our flexibility in shifting to a maximum use? And if we don't, what can we actually take away the trees, or if they start dying, how does that affect the cost of the carbon credits?
Representative Cologne through the chair, there's a lot of good questions in there. Let me try and take them in stages. I think that, you know, you mentioned there's a perception that you're locking up that land for that period of time. And really, I think you're not locking up the land. You are committing to managing the land in a certain way for that period of time. That management can still, in the case of these improved forest management projects, they're conditional on timber harvest occurring in the first place and continuing to some degree. You're locking in that management commitment rather than locking up the land to uses. As far as the access for the public and whatnot, broadly, these lands should very easily still be completely available. There's actually language in the bill for both the state program and for the leases that, to the extent possible, it shall remain open. I say to the extent possible, particularly in the third-party leases of state land, there may be some instances, depending on what kind of a project the third party is conceiving, where they might need a varying degree of site control in all or some of that property. So kind of cushioning that a little bit. I think that you also look, you know, like long-term, what if, right? So what if in 30 years, 20 years, this is something that the state is no longer feeling is in the interests? There is the ability to terminate a project. There is the ability to remove part of a project an ability to remove some of the land from the project. You need to account in doing so for that loss of carbon storage that was on that part of that land. So there are financial consequences to doing that kind of reversal. This is an interesting area in a heavy level of jargon, but there's an official term for that. It is a reversal because you are reversing the carbon storage that you were maintaining in the project. So in those instances where you're taking a direct action to change that scenario, it is possible that there are consequences. There are also what they call involuntary reversals, and these are maybe more, you talked about bugs, beetles, insects. Involuntary reversals are, I guess, acts of God, fire, extreme drought, insect infestation, wind events that take out some of your trees. And in that instance, obviously, you have lost the carbon storage that those trees were providing. The registries require projects, particularly forestry projects, to pay in part of their credits that are issued to a risk buffer. It's essentially an insurance type of pool so that you can mitigate against that kind of a loss.
Maybe if I could just add a little more detail to that. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee, for the record. again, I think the best way of looking at carbon offset as it relates to forested land is thinking about it in the context of enhanced forest management. So carbon credits can actually incentivize more proactive management of our forests. And I think a great example to look to is, you know, the forests that we have, you know, around the Anchorage Bowl, the Kenai, and the Mat-Su Valley. You know, we've watched over the past 5 years, or even a little longer than that, you know, the spruce bark beetle infestation. And we have millions of acres now of trees that are dead or dying that, you know, will eventually just stand there, the wind will blow them over, or we'll have a major wildfire and, you know, it'll all burn. So, you know, under a carbon offset project, you know, a developer could be incentivized and actually go out to those areas to harvest the dead timber and then more quickly and more proactively, you know, replant the trees. And in the process of doing that, you know, you could replant, you know, a higher value species like a white spruce versus, you know, allowing lower value species like cottonwood to grow up. And in the process of kind of managing these, you know, these areas for, you know, carbon management, you're replanting new trees, which of course are growing and absorbing more carbon out of the atmosphere. You might be employing other management, you know, practices to ensure that the trees are growing well, that they're properly spaced, that they're not being smothered by grass or alders or things like that. And again, by sort of managing maybe more around a particular type of wood, you know, over the intervening, you know, years and decades, what you're doing is you're raising up then a higher quality stock of timber. And if you can kind of visualize, if you set aside a particular area of land, and we'll just say 100 acres just for the ease of argument, every year in that 100 acres, you know, new trees are growing or the existing trees that you have are growing bigger, so they're absorbing more carbon. So in effect, that area of land then is entitled to, you know, an additional margin of carbon credits. And it's within that additional margin then that you can support a sustainable logging program where you're harvesting, you know, older or more mature timber that is merchantable. It would support, oh, you know, we want to actually build a road through here now because we want to develop resources that are adjacent to that. So we're going to clear a certain amount of our trees in order to build a road or other infrastructure. It would provide for that. Or, you know, there's, as Raina mentioned, there's provisions that if somehow we, you know, discovered a really valuable deposit of minerals, depending on the actual size of the carbon offset project, it may be perfectly, you may be perfectly capable of developing a mine within a carbon offset area because the footprint of the mine wouldn't exceed the amount of additional carbon credit margins that you're basically earning every year based on that project area's ability to absorb more carbon. So, you know, really, you know, to get to your earlier question about, you know, locking up land, carbon credits will very likely help incentivize and revitalize a timber industry, particularly in our interior forests, because it will provide an additional economic mechanism that will make more, you know, forest product type activities economic for a developer that's working not only to harvest trees, because we have to remember, you know, this table in front of us and the dais up there, I mean, this is sequestered carbon. This is carbon that will be sequestered for, you know, decades. So, you know, our existing, you know, focus on harvesting timber, utilizing our forests, it's not inapposite with doing a carbon offset project. It just means that, you know, the harvesting and the way that we manage our forests will just need to be in compliance with the particular terms of, you know, whatever program we're involved in.
Okay, thank you.
Please proceed, Ms. Miller.
For the record, Rena Miller. I will just add the foundational, to sum it up, is to grow more than you harvest within that project area. We have a quick look here at the state project process. And Mr. Chairman, I know time is running short and you'd like to hear an overview of the CCUS. Would you like me to go through this or save it for the next and move on to CCS, or would you like to talk through this?
You know, I was thinking I don't want to rush through the CCUS, and so we're going to be we want the committee to be comfortable with this. This is a emerging new market, and I know that there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of need for folks to become comfortable with this, so we certainly don't want to rush it. So I think what we'll do is we'll bring this back again, and we'll give folks a chance to really talk this through. I don't want to, in less than 10 minutes, try to get through the whole thing. So go ahead and take your time on this slide, and then we'll adjourn after that.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This slide is just supposed to be a very high-level overview of what the state project process might look like. On the left, we start with a concept and building feasibility of that concept. I think the ANU report on its potential pilot projects is an example of where you might start that way. You then phase into that project development stage. The state, of course, as the commissioner spoke of, could do this on its own as the project developer. The state, as the project proponent, could also hire a firm to be its project developer. There's a number of firms out there that do that kind of work. They have different business models. Some of them will take those upfront costs of the project development and be repaid once the credits are generating, which is certainly an option available. So the project gets developed. ANU projects 18 to 24 months to develop a project to the point where it's generating offset credits. 18 months is efficient, and of course in Alaska, due to the need for on-the-ground work, field seasons can be tricky. So accounting for two, give it 24 months just to be on the safe side there. During that project development phase, you have people out literally measuring trees, preparing the data that goes into some of the computer modeling and the calculations that are set by the registry standards as to how much carbon your trees are storing. That standard, some of those calculations involve, there's separate measurements for dead standing trees, there's separate measurements for on the ground dead trees, they're calculating everything, what you're storing in carbon. Eventually, you have kind of a project design and concept. Fundamentally, under that improved forest management construct, it is that commitment to manage in a certain way over time. As the commissioner pointed out, there are added activities that can be done that over that project term increase the carbon storage of that land. And those are more hands-on activities rather than that baseline commitment to manage your forests in a certain way in your harvests. All of this stuff gets wrapped up and fed into the registry. They take a look at it. They require essentially that you retain a third party to audit all of those findings and to go over all those calculations, make sure all those rules were followed. At that point, there's some back and forth between the project and the auditor and the registry. Once they're ready to sign off on that as having met all of the standards and rules, then they are able to start generating credits to your project. Different protocols at different registries can generate those in different time scale. You think you'll see when you look at that ANU report that they're looking at a pretty steady flow of credits generated annually over the years. There are ongoing monitoring reports that have to be done. You'll have plots within your project area that need to be measured on an ongoing basis. Every 5 years, I believe, you're out there doing that field work again. Which does add some component of cost on an ongoing basis. And then each time that you go and do this update and plug that in with the registry, then they can issue additional credits to you for that additional carbon that's being stored on your landscape.
Okay.
I am happy to take any questions at this point.
Yeah, Representative Colomb and then Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, this is actually for Commissioner Designee Boyle. So one of the things I'm concerned about all of the carbon offsets is, because there's pressure to do this, isn't it ultimately going to raise the cost of energy? Since corporations have to buy these offsets, it's going to add to expense. They're not going to absorb that. They're going to transfer it down to us. And we're already having, especially in rural Alaska, a lot of problems with the cost of fuel and other ways for energy.
Yeah, Representative Kloom, through the chair, I think that's a good question. I think Representative Edgman actually addressed a lot of that in his kind of earlier remarks, which is, you know, this activity, this, you know, commitment to net zero, whether it's being made voluntarily by companies based on shareholder or board of director pressure, or whether or not it's being driven, as the representative pointed out, by the fact that many other countries around the world are imposing either carbon taxes or carbon emissions limits on, you know, industry that's operating within their jurisdictions. You know, that's what's driving this activity. So, you know, from the state's perspective, our entry or our participation in this space isn't a cost driver. It's really an off-ramp that enables those types of companies then to divert revenues to the state coffers, as opposed to diverting those revenues to another country's coffers or, you know, somewhere else. So I guess you could argue in some ways that based on the benefits that would accrue to the state of Alaska through sequestering carbon underground, growing the permanent fund, or just growing, you know, our general fund revenues in general, at least then the revenues that are coming to the state are actually being redistributed out amongst, you know, Alaska residents to offset the you know, whatever additional costs might be associated with these activities. But again, it's not the state it's not Alaska state policy driving these costs, and it's not providing this regulatory structure in the state that's driving the costs. The costs are being driven by, again, the voluntary decisions of these companies and or, you know, other jurisdictions, you know, compliance and regulatory markets. So it's really, to me, it's more of a question is, does the state choose to participate and drive benefits, which we can use to help people manage around these costs, or do we just watch the investment go somewhere else and derive no benefit from it, at least from my viewpoint?
Can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up?
Yeah, I didn't mean to intend that you personally are driving up the cost of energy, but I think it's something to consider. I support the carbon credits. I think it's a smart thing to do for the state, and it is a benefit to the state. I'm not sure it's a benefit to the consumer for energy. It definitely addresses climate change, and it has good things, but I think it's something we need to weigh in because we're already struggling with the cost of energy in our state. So I appreciate the presentation. I did not mean like it was you. I'm just like, the environment we're in where this is getting, you know, pressure to do carbon credits, that is going to be something that raises the cost of energy. So thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, appreciate Representative Palom's questions and her thoughts on that. So I've done a little bit of reading in this, which can be dangerous. I know just a little bit kind of makes you, it's a dangerous thing because you don't really know the whole picture. But one of the things they talk about is this thing called leakage. And so in my mind, when we're talking about measuring carbon that we're storing or that were the benefits that come from leaving the trees there, they suck up carbon, and that's in a project area, right? But then you have land right next to you that's outside the project area. Obviously, that land is currently sucking up some carbon, although there's no credit that's being generated from that. But it is this leakage. Can you speak to leakage in relationship to that kind of scenario that I just spoke about? Because my understanding that it draws a concern maybe from the American Carbon Registry or other folks that if we up our volume of our forest cutting activity in a neighboring area outside the project area, then the benefits of the carbon storage in that project area are not as great as they might be, and that the American Carbon Registry might get nervous about that. Does this make sense at all?
Absolutely. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, there's actually two kinds of leakage that the registries and the field look at with the carbon offset programs, and that's activity leakage and that's market leakage. And so with an activity leakage, it's that sense that if a landowner says, okay, I will make sure I store more carbon on this land by not cutting as much, but then goes to that next little bit of land that they own and makes up for it there, right? And so that would be an example of activity leakage, and the registries actually contemplate that in some of the calculations as to how much carbon, particularly with the forestry projects. And so they account for the possibility of that leakage in their calculations and methodology when they build up to the credits. There's the other one, which is market leakage. Yeah.
So you say that they anticipate then that there will be added activity in a nearby area, that they kind of anticipate that, and then they calculate that into the value of the credit that's being purchased in that one project area?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, they don't really anticipate that it will happen, but they're kind of hedging against it because it is a possibility that exists.
Okay.
With a state project, I think there's some benefit in this case to being a state landowner, where your land use plans and your harvest schedules and everything else are out there in the public domain. They're open for people to see and understand, and it's very apparent what might be happening as far as that kind of activity shift. But are those calculations that the registry is working on where they account for that leakage risk of your project. The activity leakage, the market leakage is one they also account for, and that's the sense that, well, if you're not harvesting as much from this land, people still need that amount of lumber, and so where else is that coming from? And in that same context, the registry does accommodate that, which it's good and helps, again, protect the integrity of those credits when buyers are looking for things that are legitimate and real in the emission reductions that they represent.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks. Last question. We've got Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Foster. It's more of a comment and thought. Today is the 24th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez disaster, and Co-Chair Edgman spoke to sort of long-term magnitude costs of, you know, we've sometimes talked about cheap energy, and it might have been cheap today, but it's not cheap over its lifetime. And the idea of us acknowledging the cost that carbon has to us and figuring out how to monetize it for a value for us is very intriguing to me. But, you know, nothing comes free, and if we didn't pay for it up front, we may pay for it over our lifetime. And, you know, whether it's trees or kelp or a barrel of oil, all of those things have a cost to us in our impact. And, you know, one of the biggest issues for us at this table looking at this legislation is the upfront cost of standing up a program before we see any economic benefit, but we also have to understand any ripple effects it has.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we are at the end of our time. We've made it through about two-thirds of the slide deck, so we still need to get through the HB 50, the introduction of the Carbon Capture, Utilization, and Storage Bill, the second bill here. I think this is going to take probably a series of meetings to get folks comfortable with the content. Thank you very much, Commissioner, as well as Special Assistant Miller. You no doubt know the information. I hope that we can get us to a point where we feel just as comfortable, maybe not as knowledgeable, but to a point where we feel comfortable moving forward with this. And so we will figure out another time to finish the presentation. I know at the beginning of next week we've got amendments. I think we're doing two a days next week, so it's going to be a pretty busy week, but we'll figure something out here. And let me see here. So with that, Commissioner Designee Boyle, do you have any closing comments before we adjourn?
No, we really just want to thank the committee for taking the time today to meet here and talk with us on this. You know, our commitment as DNRs, we're happy to meet with any of you and or your staffs individually as well, because we're fully appreciative of the fact that these are novel concepts. These are, you know, these are big ideas, and that, you know, it'll take some time to kind of digest in order to understand what it is that we're driving towards, and also just to fundamentally understand the mechanics of how these programs might work. So we're happy to work with you guys in any way that we can, and my staff, you know, will be at your disposal to help answer any of those additional questions, because we want to help the process along however we can.
Great. Thank you very much. So with that, our next scheduled meeting of the House Finance Committee is scheduled for 9 a.m. on Monday, March 27th. At that meeting, we'll be back to the budget. Like I said, we'll be taking up amendments next week. And so with that, we'll be adjourned at 3:34 p.m. Thank you, everyone.